Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an historical perspective on how wars in the past, like the Civil War, which ended slavery, and World War II, which brought about a social safety net, have enhanced American democracy, whereas since 9/11 and the War on Terror, our freedom at home has been restricted and we no longer defend democracy abroad, but threaten it. Jeremy Suri, Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, joins us to discuss his new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and his article at The Washington Post, How 9/11 Triggered Democracy's Decline. We will look into why the U.S. no longer wins wars and why we are fighting wars against our own democracy. Then we will speak with Mona Crevel, a professor of government at Cornell University, who is a fellow of the Mannheim Center for European Research at the University of Mannheim in Germany. She joins us to discuss German Chancellor Merkel's offer to participate in future nuclear talks with North Korea and her talks with Russia's President Putin, with whom she shares a growing alarm that Donald Trump is escalating the nuclear crisis with the equally unpredictable Kim Jong-un. Then finally, we'll examine the new round of sanctions on North Korea following a unanimous vote by the UN Security Council, and speak with Sung Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, who has an article at the New York Times, The Way to Make North Korea Back Down, and another at the Los Angeles Times, Why Won't the U.S. Use Its Full Sanction Power Against North Korea? We will discuss China's dilemma of not wanting to create a failed state on its border at the same time as not wanting Kim's provocations to cause more U.S., South Korean, and military power being introduced into the neighborhood. And joining us now is Jeremy Suri, who's a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's just published a new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And he has an article at the Washington Post, How 9/11 Triggered Democracy's Decline. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremy Suri.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And Jeremy, let's start with your article in the Washington Post on how 9/11 triggered democracy's decline. You make the point that America's previous wars have actually improved and built upon American democracy. The Civil War, of course, abolished slavery, and World War II promoted welfare rights, a social safety net, decent employment, higher education. And arguably, as a result of that, we had a kind of a social democracy in the United States from about 1944 to 1977. But you also point out that over the last 16 years, since 9/11, American freedoms have been diminished by this, what was called the War on Terror. But I don't know what they call it now, but let's face it, we have spending more today on defense than we did at the height of the Cold War, when we had a real enemy who could destroy the United States. In 30 minutes, every American city was targeted on a hair trigger by the Soviet Union. And here we are spending more money on a group of ragtag jihadis running around the deserts of the Middle East in pickup trucks, who basically are being rounded up and killed as we speak. So it's an odd situation, isn't it, in the broader sweep of history?
Yes. I think you've summarized some very important historical points that are very relevant to the world we live in today. I'm not advocating war in any sense, and war has been a tragedy throughout American history. Millions of Americans have died in various wars. 500,000 die in the Civil War alone. But the wars Americans have generally fought have resulted after the wars with an expansion in freedom for many groups that were denied freedom before the war. So the freeing of slaves, as you said, after the Civil War, the movement towards civil rights and greater gender equality and more social welfare rights in the United States after World War II. And this happened in these wars, Ian, not because the United States spent more or less money, but because the United States demanded the collective sacrifice of all citizens. And in return for their sacrifice on the battlefield, they were promised more freedom. This war, since September 11th, 2001, whatever we call it, has been a war where we have been afraid to ask Americans to sacrifice sacrifice. We've tried to fight the war while Americans shop, and we've tried to, in a sense, hire a constabulary army to fight for us. And as a consequence, we haven't made promises of expanding freedom. In fact, we've done the opposite. So this is the first war in American history where we have become less free the more we have fought it. And it's been a war that is actually not about freedom anymore. It's about power and dominance. And this departs, I argue, from the main strains of American history. And it's one of the reasons we're in such a terrible situation in our democracy at home today.
Well, the other question, though, is that we don't win wars anymore, not since World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and every of the post-Cold War war we've been involved in, particularly Afghanistan and Iraq. The only winner of the Iraq War are clearly the Iranians, and the Afghanistan is our longest war with no end in sight, and we're not making any progress there. So something's happened in that regard, that we're not expected to win wars anymore, or it doesn't seem to count. But as a result of the Vietnam War, which was clearly contentious and which we clearly lost, they got rid of the draft. And that, I think, has led to this dissociation between the American people and their own military, which I don't think is very healthy. Not that I'm saying we should have a draft, but maybe we should reinstate the notion of national service, where you don't have to just go into the military. You can take care of the homeless or become a nurse or an environmentalist. But, of course, that is something that's an anathema to conservatives, because that's big government, is it not?
Yes, yes. I have come to agree with you, Ian, that a draft would be a good thing. And by the way, many of the most distinguished military figures in American society today, including General McChrystal, have supported this argument as well. A draft would provide at least some basis for all citizens across classes and races to serve the public and to develop a notion of public service. But your other point, I think, is even more important. The United States has not won a war. It has not been successful militarily, really, on the scale it claims to be since World War II. And we've been lying to ourselves for a long time. We keep saying that we never lose wars. That's what President Trump said in his speech about Afghanistan, that we always win. That's actually not true. We've become so large and so powerful that we can fight a lot of losing wars and still go on and pretend that we're winning. We're sort of like that football team that loses but has enough supporters that everyone just continues to think they're a great team even when they're losing all their games. And the reason we're not doing well is because we're fighting the wrong wars in the wrong places, and we're fighting the wrong way. We're fighting without full citizen engagement. We should fight few wars, and when we fight, the entire population should be involved and behind it. That's how we win wars, and that's how we make sure our wars serve the idealistic purposes, the democratic purposes that our society should be about.
Well, you know, George Orwell in 1984 posited, you know, and that was clearly an analogy for the, or in some ways, a reflection of the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, that in effect the Soviet Union and the United States waged war on their own people, because there was no possibility of a war, really, and they essentially diverted all their resources into the Russian military-industrial complex and the American military-industrial complex. And that gets back to my question, which is a real puzzlement, is how come we have spending more on defense today and our enemy is being rounded up and they're just a bunch of hapless jihadis, very small in number to begin with, and now, of course, their number is being reduced dramatically. So what's your explanation for that?
Well, I think there are three things that explain why, as you so correctly say, we are spending so much more money on defense than, well, let's put it this way, we spend much more money on defense than we spend on infrastructure, education, and things that matter so much more for our society right now. So why do we spend this money on defense? I think there are three things at work. It is a very complicated world, and even though we don't have an adversary like the Soviet Union, there are a wide range of adversaries. So it's actually more expensive to try to cover the global range of adversaries we confront. But that might be because we're trying to do too much. We've become an empire, and we're trying to provide security for ourselves against all kinds of different actors in different regions, and that's costing us a lot of money. That's one problem. Second, and this was implied in your question, there are many organized interests in the United States, what Dwight Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. They're not conspirators, but they benefit from this world. They benefit from the purchase of aircraft. They benefit from the purchase of military materials. The state of Texas, where I live, the U.S. military is one of the largest employers. Federal contractors that serve the military are some of the largest employers. So there's a corporate welfare story that's going on. I always tell people, Ian, the United States is a welfare state. It's just sometimes the welfare goes to the businesses, not to the citizens. That's the problem. The third reason we have this big defense spending in place is because it's politically and symbolically powerful to say, I'm increasing defense spending. Maybe everyone thinks you're being strong. And so it's a symbolic way, even though you're not winning wars, of showing that you're tough. And so Donald Trump has promised to increase defense spending even more, even though he hasn't told us what he's going to use it for. But that's supposed to make us think he's tough and we're strong. It's like going to the gym. We're going to the gym some more. We're going to be a stronger country. We're going to spend more money on defense. So we're spending too much money in the wrong places, and we need to reevaluate these things. And we did that after every other war. We have been unable to do that in our society today.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeremy Suri, a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's just published a new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And he has an article at the Washington Post, How 9/11 Triggered Democracy's Decline. Let's talk a little about your new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. You make the case that essentially our presidents have become managers of the world's largest economy and the military, as we've just talked about, and they have to react to everything that's happening 24/7 around the globe. We recall the 3 a.m. phone call in the presidential campaigns, the idea that anything could happen at any moment. And of course, in this globalized world with 24-hour news cycles, particularly with a president like Donald Trump who watches television all the time, it is a constant, you're constantly whipsawed, so you're more of a manager than a visionary by definition. Is that the case?
Yes. So my book makes the argument that the problem with the presidency today is not just the person in office, that is part of the problem, but that it's a longer historical trajectory. This office was created, as I describe early in the book, as a small office designed actually not to be a managerial office in any way, nor to be an office that dominated the country, but to be a leadership office that offered a strategic vision and helped to unify the country. And that's why George Washington didn't join any party. He was supposed to be above party. He was supposed to play a unifying, forward-looking role. And our great presidents for the first 150 years did that. They amassed more power in doing that, but they used their power to bring the country forward and to bring the country together. What's happened since World War II is because our country has become so large, so complex, with so many interest groups, and our demands and interests have become so global, the president has become less a forward thinker, less a leader, less a unifier, and more someone who tries to provide goodies to different groups and appease different actors rather than serving the broader national interests of the country. And if you look at the way presidents spend their time, and I show this in the book, they spend more and more time with each successive generation since World War II on things that are not serving the interests of the country as a whole.
Just elaborate on that, if you will.
So they end up spending a lot of time, presidents do, reacting to crises. So let's take just what you were asking about before, Ian. Since the early 1970s, terrorism has preoccupied presidents of the United States, and every administration from Richard Nixon's through to the present has spent more time reacting to terrorist incidents. Now, terrorist incidents are terrible, but there has never yet really been a terrorist incident that threatened the future of the United States. Even September 11th was really not threatening to bring the collapse of the United States. Presidents have spent inordinate time chasing small numbers of terrorists around the world and not dealing with issues like the environment, issues like the future sustenance of the American economy, issues like the education of citizens. So we've diverted our resources to the smaller actors. Presidents react to crises and react to demands rather than putting together a strategy that helps advance the country, which is what their predecessors did before World War II.
Well, of course, the purpose of terrorism is to get people to react. I mean, obviously, yes. The best thing we could do about terrorism would be to ignore it. But yes. I guess we don't have the maturity, and a president who tried to ignore terrorism would be pilloried, right?
Well, I don't know. I would like to see a president try to do that. And ignoring is not completely neglecting it. But one could do things to try to contain the problem and certainly to educate the American public that this is not something that should be dominating the way we think. Let me be even more explicit about this. One of the greatest benefits to American society in the last 200 years has been the arrival of immigrants, talented immigrants, to our society. I'm the child of immigrants to the United States. If we allow our fear of terrorism to bring us to build walls and keep talented immigrants out, as we're doing now, we are undermining our national interests. We are making our society much weaker. We're allowing the terrorists to win. A president should be saying what I just said. That's a broader strategic goal. That's a view of the country as a whole. That's a unifying vision of an inclusive country. That's exactly what Franklin Roosevelt was arguing for during World War II. But we haven't had leaders who do that because leaders are incentivized instead to provide raw meat to various angry groups in the electorate and angry donors rather than the larger interests of the country. And that's what's made the presidency impossible, as I describe it.
But do you think, though, it's inherently impossible because under our system, the president is both the head of state and the political leader? And when you say that earlier presidents, starting with George Washington, were able to unify the country and be more symbolic as leaders and less political, and in Washington's case, he didn't even want to belong to a political party.
Correct.
Is that the problem, that you've got these two roles that aren't necessarily compatible?
Ian, that is one of the core themes of my book. The founding fathers actually didn't know what the presidency was going to look like, and they didn't agree. But they benefited from the fact that the office was small, the country was small, the responsibilities were small. And so, in a sense, the president could have multiple jobs at the same time, as you said. Head of state, like a king or queen, visiting with diplomats, unifying the country, also being a commander-in-chief, also being, in a sense, a prime minister with legislative agendas. And the president could do all those things. But as the country has become bigger and bigger, and my point in the book is that scale matters, as the responsibilities have grown, it's become inhuman. We suffer from gigantism. We are too big to succeed. And one single man cannot, or one single woman cannot do this job. I try to show that in great detail in the last few chapters, how very talented people like John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson struggled and failed. Even Ronald Reagan, who some sees as a success. There are so many failures because the office overwhelmed him. We need to think about this. As a country of the size we are, with the global reach we have, with the demands upon power, we're not set up in the executive office. And blowing up the system, as Donald Trump promises to do, is only going to make this worse.
Well, I mentioned earlier the conservative mantra about big government being the problem, which certainly was something that Ronald Reagan introduced. But my sense is that big money is the problem. And, you know, for example, when just before Senator Kennedy retired, and Ted Kennedy, he'd been in the Senate for a long, long time, he was asked in an interview, what's the biggest change you noticed in all your decades in the U.S. Senate? And he said, the biggest change is that we don't work anymore. We only come in on Tuesdays, work on Wednesdays, and then go back to the district on Thursday to raise money. And we raise money all over the weekends. And that's our routine. And that's the same with the House. Our members in the House are essentially telemarketers. They spend hours every day on the phone asking for money. So we've created a system where, in effect, plutocrats and big donors can buy the government, as the Koch brothers and Robert Mercer, who's pretty much bought the Trump administration, and the Koch brothers pretty much bought the Congress. That's the system we have. And my sense is that oligarchs and powerful donors, their attitude towards their political hirelings is an attitude of contempt, that they don't want to have talented people in there. They just want to have loyal functionaries who will do their bidding. And that's why Stephen Bannon is now helping elect Tea Party candidates, because they are the most loyal, if not the most, you know, insane. So how does that fit into your thesis, the idea that we have become, I think the Greeks call it timocracy, a rule by money?
Well, I think it's directly connected to what I'm talking about, which is, as power becomes centralized, it's easier for a few powerful actors to dominate power. The wisdom of the founders was that a federalist system, a system of divided authority, and I don't just mean between branches of government at the national level, but across state and local government, would make it harder, Madison claimed, for a particular interest to dominate. There would be more space for diversity, more space for different interests. And I think that would be the case today. It's not just that there are wealthy people who are trying to control the system. That's always been the case. The Rockefeller family tried in the late 19th century to control the political system. It's that right now, with gerrymandering and with the way that our parties are set up around fundraising, things are so centralized, and the presidency itself is such a centralized office now, that it's very easy for donors to do this. And a more decentralized system, devolving authority to different units, as the founders intended, would actually help us preserve democracy, it seems to me. Second point I would make along these lines is that one of the biggest problems we have in terms of representation is that we're putting people into office with expectations that are also unrealistic. And I think we as a society have to ask ourselves, what are the kinds of leaders we want? And we have to all get involved and participate. It's not just that moneyed interests are dominating our politics, it's that so many other interests are sitting out. This last election, the problem was the number of people who didn't vote, not the number of people who did vote. And you cannot blame the moneyed interests for that. That's a problem of citizen participation, which has to change. I argue in my book, we look too often for a savior so we can just go about our lives and our business rather than getting involved. The founders envisioned a much more participatory society than what we have become.
Well, indeed, we do think that every 4 years we elect a man on a white horse, and we've yet to elect a woman on a white horse, and they're going to solve all of our problems. And I think that was very much the case with Barack Obama. There was great expectation that he would be the miracle worker, and of course Obama's mantra was, yes, we can, not yes, I can. But yes, I can became our expectation, and people were disappointed in him. So you can't win. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you for having me on and for such excellent questions. That was a wonderful discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jeremy Suri, Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's just published a new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And he has an article at the Washington Post, How 9/11 Triggered Democracy's Decline. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing German Chancellor Merkel's talks with Russia's President Putin, with whom she shares a growing alarm that Donald Trump is escalating the nuclear crisis with North Korea's equally unpredictable Kim Jong-un.
Mother, do you think they'll like this song?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mona Crevel, who is a professor of government at Cornell University and a fellow at the Mannheim Center for European Social Research at the University of Mannheim in Germany. Her research focuses on the relation between media and politics, and in particular on the role of the media in election campaigns. And she is the author of Modernization of German Election Campaigns and Campaign Communications Between 1957 and 1965. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mona Crevel.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mona. And obviously, there's an important election underway in Germany, although it looks as though it's going to be a bit of a walk for Angela Merkel. But let's talk a little about, she's resumed her phone conversations with Vladimir Putin, and they apparently had a long talk yesterday about figuring out how to play a role in dampening down the tensions between the United States and North Korea. And as you know, the UN just passed an extra package of sanctions and said the North Koreans in return said that they would inflict great pain on the United States. So we've had this overwrought rhetoric going on. But my understanding is that in Germany and in Europe, there are genuine concerns and worries about Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un's rhetoric and threats going back and forth. And there's also added to that, there's a concern in Germany that Trump may also pull out of the P5 plus one deal with Iran. So let's deal with those anxieties. Are they real?
Yes, they are real. And on the other hand, Merkel is also campaigning at the moment. That is something we have to keep in mind. So first of all, she had a phone call with Putin yesterday. I wouldn't overestimate it. I was actually surprised that it was more covered in the American media than it was in the German media. So they were downplaying it a lot more because she had phone calls with Emmanuel Macron before and also with Trump. But Germany is worried about North Korea and Kim Jong-un and about Trump. They have been worried about Trump right from the beginning after the election already. But you can say Germany is one of the few countries who actually have diplomatic relationships with Pyongyang. And they haven't been asked to go on that peace mission and talk to Pyongyang diplomatically yet. So that is what the spokesperson of Angela Merkel said. But they are trying to de-escalate the situation for the reason that they have these diplomatic ties with Pyongyang, but also for the reason that Merkel currently is campaigning in Europe. And I think she would like to be associated with peace as a peace chancellor. That has already worked out for other incumbents before her, like Gerhard Schröder, who in 2005 said he would not go, he would not send German troops to Iraq, even if he wasn't asked by the U.S. at that time to do so. But his clear no helped him during this election campaign. And the same is here also a bit the case for Merkel, being the one who is supporting a peaceful way to solve the problems between the U.S. and North Korea. It's something that German voters definitely want to see her. It also helps her talking to Putin, to Trump, to Macron, to demonstrate her leadership qualities across the German voters.
So is it possible, though, that as much as what you've explained, that running as a peacemaker is going to help Angela Merkel in her election in Germany and in Europe at large, could it also help reinvent Vladimir Putin? I mean, after all, Vladimir Putin presides over a nuclear arsenal slightly bigger than the United States. And if there are concerns about the stability of Donald Trump, which were expressed, by the way, by a Republican senator, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Corker, who questioned Trump's stability, I think that's not a very ambiguous indication of perhaps an allusion to mental stability. Is it possible that Putin could say, you know, I'm the steward of this vast arsenal and we don't want to be on a hair trigger alert all the time and have the fate of the world in our hands if the president of the United States is not showing sufficient stability? Do you think that's a possibility?
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, I think like Putin is also taking his chance here because of Donald Trump on the other side. So he has his chance now to be seen as a peacemaker as well. And he's also kind of approaching Merkel over the Ukraine crisis that he's doing the same. He's kind of saying he is suggesting a UN peacekeeping mission in Donbass. And even if Merkel said there are still some changes on the mandate that need to be made, this actually found the approval of Putin, who on his part offered to repeal the limitation of the mission to the contact line. And instead, the peacekeeping mission should now protect the OSCE observers where they are working, according to the Minsk package of measures. So therefore, there seems to be incremental improvements made in this question as well, which kind of shows to me that he's trying to create the image that he's the better guy out there. That he can be a peacemaker in a situation where we have Kim Jong-un on one side and Trump on the other, that he takes his chance to kind of create a different image.
And again, I'm speaking with Mona Crevel, who's a professor of government at Cornell University and a fellow at the Mannheim Center for European Social Research at the University of Mannheim in Germany. Her research focuses on the relations between media and politics, and in particular on the role of the media in election campaigns. And she's the author of Modernization of German Election Campaigns, Campaign Communications between 1957 and 1965. So turning to the other issue, the P5+1 agreement with Iran, and there does seem to be apparently, it was a very contentious meeting in the White House when President Trump agreed to certify, which has to be done every 90 days under the agreement, to certify the P5+1 agreement with Iran. And there were acrimony between Stephen Bannon and Secretary Tillerson, who was apparently insulted. And it was quite apparently a nasty meeting. And Trump very grudgingly agreed to the 90-day extension. But it will come up soon. And a lot of analysts think that, again, because it's a campaign promise, and more importantly, I think, because it's something that Obama did, and Trump seems to be fixated on undoing anything and everything that Obama did, it's quite likely that the U.S. will pull out of that agreement. But Germany, of course, is a part of the agreement. That's the plus one. And so is Russia. So would that, if the U.S. pulls out, would that also bring Russia and Germany closer together?
I think so, yes. This would definitely bring Russia and Germany closer together, because Trump would have been proven one more time that he is not a stable negotiation partner. And that would be something where Putin could once again grab his chance to enhance his relationship with Germany. Yeah, definitely.
So President Trump, of course, has dismissed the ramping up of sanctions by the UN Security Council, which were watered down from what the U.S. was hoping for or demanding. And there is obviously some bite to them in terms of restricting exports of textiles, etc. But in general, Trump sort of dismissed it as saying it's not a very big deal. Mm-hmm. And there'll be more later. So again, he's back in his threatening mode. What can Germany do in terms of its representation there? What's your understanding of how they interact with the North Korean regime? We know the U.S. uses Sweden as its interlocutor, but could Germany step up in terms of its diplomatic efforts inside of North Korea?
I think Germany has to be very careful. They have diplomatic relations with Pyongyang, so they could take to Pyongyang, but I think they wouldn't do it without the backup by at least France, Japan, South Korea, and perhaps also the U.S. I think perhaps Merkel and Putin are also joining, like others, to calm Trump down. He has not gotten what he wanted with the UN resolution fully, because Beijing would not have willing to support the proposal otherwise. Russia would have not. So he has not fully gotten what he wanted. But there are also reasonable forces within the Trump administration. So Tillerson, for example, said that he would be willing to negotiate if Pyongyang freezes its nuclear program. Also the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. said that this was not a point of no return. There is still a chance for North Korea. So having a go from others, I think perhaps Germany could start talking incrementally, stepwise with Pyongyang, possibly. Yeah.
And again, I'm speaking with Mona Crevel, who's a professor of government at Cornell University and a fellow at the Mannheim Center for European Social Research at the University of Mannheim in Germany. Her research focuses on the relations between media and politics, and in particular on the role of the media in election campaigns. And she's the author of Modernization of German Election Campaigns, Campaign Communications between 1957 and 1965. And in terms of Putin, do you think that he could reinvent himself and get in any way get out from under the inquiries going on in this country about Russian interference in the last election? In other words, could the arsonist become the fire brigade? Or do you think that that scandal, since it's already being investigated by a special counsel, and every day there seems to be more and more revelations, which the press seizes on, so what's your sense, since you're both a German scholar, but you also here in the United States, whether or not?
I think actually that he probably cannot fully wash his hands pretend that this has never happened. It's much of a big issue. But the fact that nothing has happened like this in the German election so far, where there would have been a lot of stake for them, shows that they are kind of trying to change the image of Russia also. So in the German election, we might have expected, because after the hacking attack in 2015, into the computer network of the German parliament, that some of the fruits of this hacking would be revealed during the hot phase of the election campaign. But nothing has happened so far. So even there haven't been any Russian propaganda networks trying to launch any massive disinformation campaigns. The votes remain silent. So even though for Russia there's a lot of stakes, so Merkel had her duels with Putin in the past, and she has taken a strong stance on Russia. So for Russia, other parties competing on the left and on the right who have softer positions towards Russia would have been a better choice. But oddly, nothing happened so far. And so some people think it's useless for Russia to interfere in the German election this time because Merkel is way ahead of Martin Schulz. And the AfD, who is pro-Russia, will make it into the Bundestag even without the help of the Russians. But some others also say they have overplayed it in the U.S. case. Perhaps that's why they are trying to keep things low this time, and because it's always a risk for them to interfere in an election, in particular because they have overplayed this U.S. case, and it will never fully restore the image of Putin after this. So for many people, he's the one who has run this election, and this will be always be in the minds of people, I think.
And the AD that you mentioned is the right-wing nationalist party in Germany. So is it because then Putin has learned his lesson that it didn't work, in that it backfired, his interference in the Dutch elections and in the French elections? Or do you think he's doing this because he wants to repair his relationship with Merkel?
Both. First of all, it has kind of paid off for him. So Trump is elected, which this is not too bad for him. So, but on the other hand, I think Merkel will win this election more or less anyway, and the AfD, which is the right-wing party that is pro-Russian, will make it into the Bundestag without any Russian help, so it was not worth it to risk another interference here. And also, Russia's strategy is usually destabilizing European societies, which is less easy in Germany because German voters, even after 12 years, seem to vote for Merkel and are reluctant to change. So it's not working that well for Russia here. So perhaps that's why they are trying to keep their hands out of this election. We will not fully know until September 24, until the election. So it's still possible that something is happening very shortly before the election, but cyber securities are alarmed. So they have even warned already that Russian hackers could manipulate the vote count. Checking, as far as I know, the respective websites hourly for leaked new documents from the Bundestag. But it was just one attempt so far to hit Merkel's website with thousands of cyber attacks, of which some were Russian, obviously. But this was it, basically. Nothing else happened. So there are several reasons for which Russia might have decided to keep their hands out of the German election this time. For an image change, for the fact that it's not worth it in case of the German election, and perhaps also because of the reason that Germany has recently reacted publicly very sharply, actually, for the Russian sabotage. So that's why perhaps we don't see any of these attempts so far.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, it does seem, though, that things are sort of coming out in the open a little more in Russia, which is sort of interesting. Just the other day, the leader of a far right-wing Russian party in the Duma was on a political talk show, and he said it's time for us, the Russians, to release the compromising material we'll have on Donald Trump. And when he was asked about whether we have it, he said, of course we have it. And then just yesterday, I think it was actually the Speaker of the Duma was I think it might have been the same political talk show, where he let it slip that we, the Russians, elected Donald Trump, he said so proudly. So what's your sense of whether the cat's going to come out of the bag?
Perhaps there's still something to come. We don't know. I would like to see, perhaps personally, more that they have something interesting about Angela Merkel. I don't know. But perhaps there is still something coming. But I think some Russians are still proud of this, and they cannot keep it for themselves. So they kind of threaten the U.S. On regular interviews that there is something to come.
Right. Well, of course, we've all seen the picture of Angela Merkel sitting down with Putin, and Putin knows mm-hmm. that Angela Merkel was terrified of dogs, so he had these big black lab come into the meeting. You can see the look of terror on her face as this mm-hmm. big dog plunks down next to her. So
that was a demonstration of power, I guess.
Right. Well, Monique Revel, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mona Crevel, who is a professor of government at Cornell University and a fellow at the Mannheim Center for European Social Research at the University of Mannheim in Germany. Her research focuses on the relation between media and politics, and in particular on the role of the media in election campaigns. And she is the author of Modernization of German Election Campaigns, Campaign Communications Between 1957 and 1965. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the new round of sanctions on North Korea following a unanimous vote by the UN Security Council. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sang-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. He has an op-ed in the New York Times, The Way to Make North Korea Back Down, and another op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Why Won't the U.S. Use Its Full Sanction Power Against North Korea? Welcome to Background Briefing, Sang-Yoon Lee.
Thank you.
And the U.N. voted unanimously to ramp up sanctions further on North Korea. It wasn't what the U.S. wanted. It was considerably watered down. The president said at the White House today it's not a big deal, but he threatened, in effect, that there'll be more to come later. So Trump's pretty much dismissed what they've done. So let's talk about what they've done. Is, in your mind, has this new round of sanctions amounted to anything?
It is an important, necessary step. The international community needs to build precedents, needs to make their case against North Korea, calling for tougher measures, ways of putting meaningful financial pressure on North Korea. It really takes the world to enforce uniformly sanctions against North Korea. If there are violators, and we know there are, then any sanctions regime against North Korea or any other target will be watered down. We know there has been back and forth within the Security Council between the U.S. and China and the U.S. and Russia. There has been some compromise, of course, and this is a compromise agreement. But what this suggests is also that there is a long path ahead of incremental escalation in terms of tougher sanctions against North Korea with every North Korean provocation. I'm about to lose count of how many UN Security Council resolutions have come out since North Korea's first nuclear test in October 2006, more than a decade ago, at least 10, and there'll be more because there will be more North Korean provocations.
So the fact that they've cut imports of North Korean textiles, does that amount to anything?
It does. North Korea reportedly makes about $800 million, perhaps close to $1 billion from its textile exports. And it is true that with every sanctions measure, there is a negative trickle-down effect. Some North Korean laborers will be out of jobs as a result of this. But we also know that there are many ways of sanctions evasion that North Korea and China have been colluding to advance North Korea's economic interests and China's political interests in propping up the North Korean regime. For example, North Korean-made goods are miraculously turned into made in China. They come with the made in China label, and clothing items have been sold under that guise for many years now. However, I think China is now seeing that in the long run, China's unconditional support for the Kim regime is not really in China's interest. We will have to come to a critical point. Things, that is, will have to get a lot worse before they get better, because to the North Korean regime that faces across its southern border a far more attractive, prosperous, you know, freer, more legitimate Korean state that acts as a magnet to the North Korean people themselves, nuclear ability, the ability to extort aid, to blackmail South Korea, and to threaten the United States to undermine the legitimacy of the South Korean government and its ability to be an attractive destination for your own people, that is a non-negotiable proposition. North Korea needs to compete with, not only compete with, but not only keep up with, but ultimately be able to dominate South Korea, and nuclear weapons and missile capabilities are the one panacea that perhaps will allow North Korea to have its way one day.
Well, when Donald Trump said today, meeting with Malaysia's Prime Minister in the White House, who, by the way, is under investigation by the United States Department of Justice, he dismissed, as I said, that these sanctions are not a big deal, but tougher measures are coming from us. I can't exactly remember what he said, but he was implying that they were going to get tougher. What can the U.S. do? I mean, I think the U.S. wanted to be able to board North Korean ships at sea, which is a pretty provocative thing to do. I think the provisions in this new round of U.N. sanctions indicate inspections in ports, but not at sea. So what do you think Trump has up his sleeve?
Well, Trump certainly wants to go there to use force, if necessary, to board North Korean ships suspected of transporting banned weapons materiel. But we are not at that stage because, yes, indeed, that is provocative and that may lead to exchange of fire, further escalation, and we don't want that. At the same time, there is a lot that the U.S. can do, taking measures that are non-military, non-lethal, and entirely legitimate in the eyes of the world, which is to enforce sanctions. We have tough sanctions coming out of the UN Security Council, Council on paper, but the toughest sanctions on paper will bear no fruitful effect if they are not enforced. Like domestic law enforcement, sanctions enforcement takes a lot of time and effort. And the truth of the matter is, no country, including the U.S. and South Korea and other allies, have ever in any meaningful way enforced sanctions against North Korea. Until last year, when the U.S. passed finally a tough sanctions legislation, U.S. sanctions against North Korea were far weaker in both degree and kind than U.S. sanctions against countries like Zimbabwe, countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo, that pose no security threat to the United States. The problem is the Trump administration has yet to fully enforce these sanctions, going after not only North Korean proliferators and designated North Korean banks and enterprises, but also enforcing secondary sanctions, so-called, which is entirely legitimate, going after the primary target's partners, which we know primarily remain Chinese. The U.S. has to do that.
And again, I'm speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. And in your op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, why won't the U.S. use its full sanction power against North Korea? You point out that the U.S. fined France's largest bank, BNP Paribas, $8.9 billion for violating the Iran sanctions, and they actually had to pay up. Meanwhile, Chinese banks being used as conduits for, as cutouts, I guess, for North Korean sanction busting. I think the Chinese banks have been put on notice, though, haven't they? Aren't they? Are they getting nervous, or do you think the U.S. will be able to deliver on its threats?
Well, the Chinese banks are getting nervous, but I don't think they're terribly nervous at this point, because nothing on that scale of a fine of close to $9 billion, no such penalty has ever been levied against a Chinese entity, a Chinese bank or state-owned company, although we know that so many Chinese entities are in blatant violation of both U.S. and U.N. sanctions against North Korea. The U.S. Treasury Department in June this year designated a bank in Dandong, just across the river, just across the border between North Korea and China, across the Yalu River, which we know has long been facilitating money laundering and proliferation activities on behalf of North Korea. But that is a very small bank. It is something that the Chinese can accept, whereas if the U.S. were to levy fines of billions of dollars on China's biggest banks like the Industrial Commercial Bank, Agriculture Bank, Bank of China, Construction Bank, these are some of the biggest banks in the world, then I think there would be a ripple effect, there would be greater compliance and a move away from doing business with North Korean entities. We've seen that pattern play out in the past. China doesn't go berserk and retaliate economically against these measures, which are completely supported with evidence. China actually tries to cut its losses and comply with these measures. And I think the U.S. has been really self-deterred, afraid of taking such aggressive financial actions against Chinese entities for fear of economic retaliation. I think history shows otherwise. Through non-lethal means, there are ways of putting meaningful pressure on North Korea, isolating North Korea financially, and it will take time for that kind of measure to produce results. You know, sanctions are no magic wand you can wave and expect, you know, for immediate change in North Korean behavior. It will take time. It took at least 2 years, more than 2 years, for Iran to return to the negotiating tables due to the biting sanctions.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, Sung-Yoon Lee, obviously the Chinese don't want the North Korean economy to collapse. That's why they didn't cut off all oil exports. But on the other hand, China, if there's a country that could in any way bring about regime change in North Korea without a collapse, it would be China. Does China have a spy network? Do they have the military means to do so? Would a coup be possible? I know that Kim killed his uncle because he was close to the Chinese, and he killed his older half-brother because he was under Chinese protection and might have been a replacement for him. Just in the last minute, what do you think of that scenario? Is it any possibility of that?
China certainly has the capability to obliterate the political construct known as the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. China certainly has the ability to seek a regime change in North Korea, and probably the U.S. and South Korea, provided there is a constant line of communication by China to the U.S. and South Korea, will not object. But China does not want to go there. Even historically, going back centuries, China has seldom, if ever, try to replace a Korean king, although China overwhelmed Korea with its size and opulence and power, of course. China right now is okay with the status quo. North Korea that depends on China, that in some ways does some of China's dirty work, putting pressure on the United States, which of course is China's long-term strategic competitor. But at some point, Chinese calculations will change because North Korea will continue to be a menace to the region. North Korea will continue to provoke the United States. And the closer we get to a point of military clash between North Korea and the United States, the Chinese may come to reconsider their interests in the Korean Peninsula and be more prone to waving goodbye to North Korea, because the end of North Korea and the formation of a united Korea of 80 or 90 million people that will, of course, remain pro-US, but also of necessity and of volition, remain pro-China, will pose no threat to China. China could live with that, but doesn't want to go there at this point.
And again, I'm speaking with Sang-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Well, of course, North Korea clearly and deliberately let off their hydrogen bomb when President Xi of China was hosting the BRICS conference and meeting with Putin. That was seemed like a deliberate insult to the Chinese leader, and for that matter to Putin as well. I believe that there's a big national holiday coming up in North Korea in October, and there's an expectation that they're going to fire another ICBM. So nobody seems to be restraining Kim from insulting anybody and everybody around the world.
The national holiday was September 9th, so that passed without an incident. But there's a big one coming out, a major national North Korean holiday. The next one is October 10th, which is Party Founding Day. And in the past, North Korea, well, conducted its first nuclear test on the eve of Party Founding Day in 2006. North Korea has been known to do these things on a major holiday, both theirs as well as America's and even Chinese. It is a way of rubbing it in, of course, adding insult to injury, but it's also effective in that it really paints North Korea's adversary further into a corner as more and more people are giving the issue attention, as more journalists are competing to cover this topic and demanding of the U.S. government and other governments, what is your response? There is greater political pressure to come up with a response, and over the past 20 years, the response has been usually fiery rhetoric, unacceptable, serious consequences, and then returning to negotiations with a lot of concessions. So North Korea is calculating, it is very crafty, and North Korea has insulted Chinese leaders, going back all the way to Chairman Mao and Deng Xiaoping repeatedly. And do you know what the Chinese did? Each time they grit their teeth and acted like adults, if you will, and increased aid to North Korea. Even as they were incensed by North Korean actions, they increased trade, increased aid to North Korea out of strategic considerations, and that includes including Xi Jinping, who was incensed when North Korea conducted its first nuclear test in the Xi Jinping era during China's most important national holiday, Lunar New Year celebrations in February 2013. Xi Jinping reportedly told President Obama, I'm going to teach him a lesson, I'm really going to squeeze him this time, but in fact increased aid to North Korea and two-way trade between China and North Korea for the rest of the year for 2013 hit an all-time high of $6.5 billion. That's the Chinese, you know, end game, to prop up North Korea, because North Korea serves Chinese interests in being a useful buffer state.
Thank you so much for joining us here today, Sang-Yoon Lee.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Sang-Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One time, one night.
the headlines.